Mr. Stevens was an extremely bright man and made fantastic academic record at Lawrence College. I know, no doubt, straight A student. And after that, he became very interested in graduate study. He married a young woman, also a Lawrence College graduate, named Ruth Davis. Her brother was Richard S. Davis, who was so famous on the Milwaukee Journal as a reporter. And David sought graduate study at the universities of Northwestern and at the University of Chicago, where he got his PhD degree. He was very close to the presidents of both of those institutions. He became vice president of Northwestern, and then when he became a teacher at the University of Chicago a little later, he was given administrative duties as an assistant to the president there, and that president at that time was Max Mason, who used to be here.
Oh yes, he's a familiar name to me.
Oh yes, and Max Mason had married the wife of a professor of physiology in the medical school here, and the commentary and, I suppose, minor scandal in those days attached to this kind of thing was instrumental in getting Mason removed as president of the University of Chicago. And he immediately accepted the presidency of the Rockefeller Foundation in New York. And the first thing he did was to offer Dave Stevens an opportunity to come and work with him in New York City. Well, the money was so much better than he was getting at Chicago, and so he accepted it. And although he enjoyed teaching, he was a Milton scholar, actually. Mm. And he followed Max Mason to New York and was made president of what they called the General Education Board, which was charged with the development of black colleges throughout the South and other kinds of work, particularly with deprived areas and deprived people and so forth. And the Rockefeller Foundation poured millions into that kind of thing for a considerable length of while. Most of the Southern colleges were developed really by David, or through his influences in getting them help for things that he could do. Well, then he came back. He was made then director of humanities for the Rockefeller Foundation, and this seemed to fit his bent really well. And he became, within a short while, the kind of spiritual center of many younger writers, musicians, and so forth, who were trying to interpret the American scene. That is what David was chiefly interested in, as better, deeper interpretations of America through the arts. And so he made funds available to a whole galaxy of brilliant younger men and women, some of whom became world famous. And
some come to mind?
Well, Paul Green, for example, was one of his. Robert Sherwood, the playwright. I don't know, you could reel them off. I could think of a lot of them, but there are many. He was very keenly concerned about the state of American culture, among other things he did was to try to establish centers of development with a very selective number of universities and colleges throughout the whole United States, such as University of California, Stanford, University of Wisconsin, North Carolina University, this kind of thing, were really places where he was supporting programs heavily and developing regional influences in the arts. My association with him began in 1938 when my interest in those years was writing plays, and I had written several plays I thought were quite good, and my professor at Cornell, where I had gone for graduate work, was pretty sold on my work. Well, anyway, he phoned up David Stevens and arranged for me to come to New York City to meet Stevens and to see if there was any possibility of a Rockefeller grant or fellowship available to me so that I could continue to work in New York State with indigenous dramatic materials.
Yes, you described that.
I think
bit.
I did, yeah. So I did that, and I think I told you how Professor Drummond lent me the money to go to New York. I'm sure that that's what happened, because I didn't have any money. And there I met Mr. Stevens for the first time, and from our first meeting, we liked each other for some reason, intuitive, no doubt. But he sensed that I was very close to ideas that he himself had felt were very important, such as the development of a folklore collection in different parts of the country, development of native drama, development of talents in the theater, development of the arts in general. All these things were important to him. So he took me under his wing from 1938, when I first knew him, until his death in 1978. We were extremely close. When he retired from his work at the Rockefeller Foundation in 1950, he and Ruth moved to Ephraim, Wisconsin. They had a summer house there, which they remodeled into a wintertime residence. And from that time on, they lived there the rest of their lives, chiefly. Beautiful, beautiful location, high up on the cliff in the meadow above Eagle Bay. And they owned the land right down to Eagle Bay. Fantastic place. I don't know, I suppose now you probably couldn't buy it for $300,000 or more. But in those days, when he first bought the farm, I think he said he paid $450 for it, or
gracious,
something like that. Well, that's the way it has gone. I having him so accessible, I made many, many trips back and forth between Madison and Ephraim to confer with him on different.
So you continued your association with him?
Constantly. And they had a bluff cabin with a fireplace in it, which they made available to me when I was working on some writing and wanted to get away from Madison. I had that always accessible.
Oh, how great.
And so I look upon him as probably the chief influence that I have had in the work that I wanted to do, as well as having a very, very deep friendship that finally ended up in the Rockefeller Foundation financing me to record his memories of work that he had done with the Rockefeller Foundation during the Depression years. and the subsequent decade through the World War II and so forth, in which he was chiefly responsible for the building of the Bodleian Library at Oxford University.
Oh my.
I don't know, almost any big, great thing he had a hand in somewhere. So I guess if I had to point out any one person, I'd point out Stevens as having major influence on me. He was always available, always had time to talk about this program or that program. I tried several times to get him to serve on different boards of one kind or another. He was always very cautious about this, although once or twice he did, for a brief time, serve on committees and boards.
Well, maybe the fact that he didn't was a help in always having time for you.
Yeah, probably so. Why he retired so early, I don't know. He was 65, no doubt, when he left the Rockefeller Foundation, but he lived to the age of 95.
Oh.
And he had at least 20 good working years where he could have, for example, the New York Times, when he retired from Rockefeller, offered him a chief editorial position with the Times, which he turned down because his wife, Ruth, was very devoted to Ephraim and to their property there, and she wanted a release from the tensions that were always apparent in the work that he was doing. She wanted him to have a relief from that. So they lived an extremely happy, contented life. He wrote a couple of books, but he didn't do anything like the work that he was capable of doing at the time of his retirement. He could, and he never said whether he thought he should have or not. He should have accepted one of the many offers to come and serve in some high position with the State Department or something else, which no doubt he was prepared to do. He supported us here with many grants while he was with the Rockefeller Foundation, and we had a chance to do work through those funds, which we could not have done in any other way. And that's the essence of
the story. Essence of it. What's this booklet that you mentioned in connection with him?
I have one. I'll give it to you. I don't have one here. They published that at the Ephraim Foundation in at Ephraim. And it's,
oh, there's an Ephraim Foundation?
Uh-huh. And it's a very touching thing, one of the better things I ever wrote, I think. I'll see that you get a copy.
Oh, I would like one. Well, what's this foundation? The Ephraim Foundation.
It's a foundation that's meant to offer support to a cultural atmosphere in that part of the Door County Peninsula. As you know, there are many wealthy people who have property in Door County, and some of these made themselves and sometimes their money available through the Ephraim Foundation to accomplish certain things. I am sure that the early development of the Peninsula Music Festival, for example, was partly the result of the Ephraim Foundation, although developed by a few very dynamic people.
Oh, I was curious.
Yeah.
Well, now, the other thing that I have very much on my mind to talk about is your work since you retired, and notably the development of Aldebaran.
Mm-hmm. Well, as you know, I am I'm very devoted to places and people in different parts of the state. One of the places that I grew very fond of was the Spring Green area, which is a beautiful hilly and lovely green area, and almost unspoiled by commercial interests of different kinds. I also was fortunate enough to have developed a friendship with a man who has lived there all his life. His father, Ben Graves, was the farming chief of Frank Lloyd Wright. And the family lived in near proximity to Taliesin, and Robert Graves had every chance to attend anything that was going on in the Taliesin kind of circle. He grew very interested during that time in landscape architecture, for example, and became a rather well-known landscape architect. All the time he was working on this business of the native arts. How he got the idea originally, I guess I don't really know. Maybe he got a bit of it from me, but I think there were other influences that were working on him. He created an organization called the Uplands Arts Council, which was one of the first arts councils formed in Wisconsin. It was composed of delegates from different parts of the area around Spring Green and Richland Center and Dodgeville and so forth and so on. Mm-hmm. It was related to the preservation of the quality of the land, no question about that, and how this could be done, and the solicitation of support from not only the village of Spring Green and from surrounding areas and individuals. I came into that about 1962, I think, or maybe somewhere such year as that. And from that time on, have been constantly associated with cultural affairs and developments in the Uplands area, in the Spring Green area. It was not always smooth sailing. We had some hard times. One of the elements in it, which was very helpful, was the interest and association of Willard and Karen Keeland, who were she was the daughter of Samuel Johnson of the Johnson Wax Company in Racine, and had very substantial funds available to her. And Bud Keeland, Willard Keeland, took an interest in doing such things as finishing the Frank Lloyd Wright restaurant, which they now call the Spring Green restaurant out there.
Oh yes, I'm familiar with it.
Well, if Willard Keeland finished from the designs that Wright drew for that, it's exactly the way he drew them.
The foundation was started a long time before, as I remember, and just was there. I remember driving by it in the early 60s.
Yeah, right.
Work hadn't progressed.
That's absolutely right. There were some beams lying on the riverbank there. That's all there was. And Wright never had the money to finish it himself. Well, then different things happened. I had established a small foundation in connection with my work, which was attached directly to the university.
What was that called?
That was called the Wisconsin Idea Theater Foundation.
Oh, yes. I see.
And that served an excellent purpose for quite a few years. And then we got this large federal grant for a rural area and small city experimentation and development. And one of the places that I picked out to work in was the Spring Green area because of the background that we had already developed there. Robert Graves was chiefly instrumental and the main leader in what was done at Spring Green. He became the chief associate of Willard Keeland on the Red and the Restaurant business and development of the Wintergreen Ski Hill and so forth, which were done also. Graves, under my advice, perhaps built with his own hands, built an amphitheater up on the side of along Highway 23 back in on property that was owned by Keelan. That went well. And what we did there, we'd bring native musicals and native plays and put them on in that amphitheater. People sat on benches, and many times we played to full houses with as many people as we could seat there. That kind of thing, no doubt, has led to the establishment of the American Players Theater, who subsequently built an amphitheater over on the O'Brien farm, which is down into the valley. And is a very nice and very beautiful amphitheater there.
What did you say it was called? Does it have a name?
The theater doesn't have a name. It's the American Players Theater.
I see.
Yeah. Graves and I have had constant meetings and relationships since our earliest days of acquaintance. And I guess I'd have to say that if it had not been for him and for his devotion and dedication, such things as the little theater in the Spring Green Village would not have been purchased and remodeled. He had many fine ideas for the beautification of Spring Green Village, some of which the town fathers didn't like because it changed things a little bit. They're not easy to change in that part of the state. So when I then was about to retire from the university faculty here, I felt that some kind of a foundation which would enable us to carry on certain parts of work that I had been interested in and which I knew the university didn't have the funds to finance, and try to get some of this done on a private basis. So we simply had our attorney, John Bremer, draw new specifications for the old Wisconsin Idea Theater Foundation. We changed its name to the Robert E. Gard Wisconsin Idea Theater Foundation, which was really not my idea to name it after myself, but they felt that this would help to some extent in getting funds and would highlight an individual on whom achievements could be pinned as well as blames and failures. So I didn't object to it. Anyway, that's the way it was done, and many things had happened around in the arts there, the development of the restaurant when Lady Bird Johnson came out to dedicate it, and all of this through activities there into a strong highlight in which I could see that sooner or later the little foundation that we had in mind could occupy quite a central position. And I think that's the way it's working out. Graves was able to purchase, and he's the one who owns the property now, to purchase the farm that had been owned by Wesley Peters, who was the chief assistant to Frank Lloyd Wright, and actually runs the apprentice program out there for Taliesin. Peters originally owned that farm, which was the James Jones farm. James Jones was the uncle of Frank Lloyd Wright. And Wesley Peters moved into the old house, which he remodeled, with his wife, who was the Stalin girl, Svetlana Stalin. And they had a brief and not very happy marriage, and eventually separated, and he moved. He didn't stay there himself, and went back under the wing of Mrs. Frank Lloyd Wright. And the property stood vacant and empty for a while, and finally it was purchased by Robert Graves. Well, he and I had been talking about what to do with this foundation, where to put it. Peters selected the name for this farm of Aldebaran, which means the follower. And what I think what he meant was that this place might well carry on and be the follower of the Frank Lloyd Wright traditions in land and architecture. I think that's the reason that name was selected.
So this is while he lived there?
Huh?
He named it that while he lived there,
with Aldebaran. Then, after Graves bought it, we talked about what to do. Peters had built a rather extensive cattle barn there. And Graves remodeled that old cattle barn. It wasn't an old one, it was a rather new one. The old one burned down. Into what has become now just a magnificent conference center and culture center, exhibit space and whatnot. It's not winterized and can't, I don't think, be used in the winter. But in the summer, it's admirable. We just last weekend had an interesting meeting on regional literature out there and had about 100 people in attendance and highlighted the work of several outstanding younger writers in the state. It was a great day. I wish you could have come to it and seen the things in action. I should have told you about it, and I forgot it. The week before, we had Lao and Cambodian refugees out there with their folk arts, and they did native dances, which were very, very beautiful. You know, those dances from that part of the country are very expressive. Every movement means a different kind of thing. That's the kind of thing the foundation is going to carry forward. We hope to have a constant stream of visitors from abroad coming out there.
Go ahead.
And then eventually we hope to establish a small international center of the folk native arts, hoping to gain groups from developing countries as well as older cultures coming there with small delegations, because we can't handle very large ones.
Where do they stay when they come?
Well, that's not so far been a problem, because our activities have been limited to one day affairs. Eventually, where somebody's going to have to build a hotel there. That can't be me. Can't be Graves. The way things are now, some big corporation has got to come in. And I think there's plenty of scope now for all of that to be a moneymaker place. People can come. Register for companies here to retrieve while employment isn't there. I can play that theater playing off on the Robert Trent Jones golf course and so forth and so on.
How are these groups organized that you bring?
Organized by me and by any other help and agency that I can get hold of. For example, the Cambodians came under the sponsorship of the American National Council of Churches. And the United States State Department, who paid their expenses by bus over there from refugee centers in Minnesota. This last weekend was arranged by a person who works part-time for us named Mary Stephenson. Whether you knew her, she used to work in McCardle Lab as Harold Rush's assistant. And she's very capable, did a magnificent job of arranging everything. I couldn't do all this alone, you know that. I have to have help.
Oh, yes. I wouldn't suppose anyone could.
There's a little money drifting into the foundation. It's not big money yet, but we get quite a